This is the Dead PB Podcast, and I am your host, Dr. Chris.
And I'm Mr. Seneca.
And we are recording this episode on December 11th, 2016, and will air this Thursday. The episode entitled is The Prince of the City, and it aired on April 3rd, 1996, the day after the pilot.
Prince of the City. Unraveling after the death of Alexandra, Frank struggles to keep his job after his informant is killed by Eddie Fiore. Frank is also hunted by Fiore, but his life is saved by Julian as their fates entwine. Julian takes into his home his wild child niece Sasha, Brigid Brangnog, his last human relation, and he begins a forbidden relationship with Julian's new bodyguard Cash, played by Channon Roe. Meanwhile, Julian begins one of his own with an investigative reporter, Caitlin Byrne, played by Kelly Rutherford, who's trying to expose him as a mobster. This episode was very political heavy, but the entire episode opens with Frank and his partner Sonny, and they're meeting, planning a stakeout, to catch Eddie taking bribes. So it's them and an informant in the car on the dock, right outside the dock workers' official union warehouse. Now, the meeting is supposed to happen at 9 p.m. So they put a wire on the informant. Now, the informant, who's this very corrupt union leader, you know, he has no qualms about, you know, what he's really doing. He actually has specific mention of a pinky ring that he wears, which is a 6-carat diamond pinky ring. So Boyle, the informant, talks a little bit about the money that he makes off of it, you know, but he's an informant, so the police allow him to do this type of corruption.
Now, this is basically something straight out of, like, The Sopranos. I mean, this whole, like, dock workers, the pinky rings, the mafiosos, the suits.
Very mobster.
Yes.
The informant wearing the wire walks in and then meets Eddie and Nino. You know, chaos ensues. Now, Frank, hearing screaming, you know, runs into the building and catches the informant, Boyle, conscious with you know, something that's actually kind of stabbed through his chest. You know, my first impression of it was that it looked like an umbrella, the way it was kind of formed, like a closed umbrella. But it, you know, whenever they flash back to the scene, I figured out later that it's not actually an umbrella. It's a piece of metal that almost looks like it's from an armchair.
Okay.
So this metal is just stabbed right through his chest, but he's conscious and calling for help.
Yeah, he's not a vampire either, by the way.
No, not at all. You know, he's not, he has no ties, you know, he's just the union leader. And Nino and Eddie basically left him there with the piece of metal sticking out, and he's conscious. So Frank, yeah, he's not a very good cop, because what he does is he actually grabs the piece of metal that's sticking out of his chest with his bare hands.
Yeah.
And then right then, you know, his backup troops, you know, and his boss run into the room.
And his partner.
And his partner, Sonny. And so they see him with his hands on the weapon, on the murder, you know, piece. And by this time, Boyle, the informant, has passed on. You know, you don't really get that so much, but it's kind of implied that at that moment, he dies. Because previously, just seconds earlier, Boyle was calling for help and conscious. So if he was still conscious when they walked in the room, then, you know, maybe they could see he was helping him. But his coworkers all just jumped to the conclusion that Frank just murdered this guy. But he's got no reason to murder him.
No, none whatsoever. But the they set it up to make it look like he had stabbed him in the chest like he would a vampire, because Frank's obsession with Julian and the death of his girlfriend. He's also been making, obviously, people unrest in the precinct and the department, because they're seeing him probably research things about vampires on computers and books. And it's really driving everyone a little crazy, as we'll show a scene later on between Sonny and Frank, which is a little funny with what Sonny says. So he's becoming unhinged, and they're convinced that he believes in his mind that vampires exist, which they obviously do, but, you know, it's a matter of the Brujah trying to push Frank over the edge completely, so he'll go after Julian. They leave him alone, which is unusual. They don't, you know, bring him back to the precinct. They're just like, you get a ride back. You walk back. We'll come and get you. And then Eddie shows up as a wolf, transforms and threatens him. And then we have our cut to the first time we have the opening credit sequence.
Yeah. And it's very startling for me that the San Francisco Police Department would just suspect Frank of committing this murder and then just kind of leave him. You know, he's fine by himself. He's a good cop, but yet he murdered this guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if it's TV logic or just bad writing.
TV logic. Then we cut back from the commercial. Oh, sorry, the opening credits in the commercial, which, by the way, those opening credits, I got to say, the first time I was watching that show, and then watching it again later on after I've seen it a couple times, there's a lot of spoilers in the opening credits.
Oh, yeah.
You see Caitlin clearly having sex with somebody, having sex with Julian. You see Sasha bleeding from her eyes. It's like, guys, wow, just give away everything that's coming up on the show soon.
Yeah, I don't know who was responsible for the title credits, but I think they should have picked some different scenes to as not clue in the audience as to what was coming up.
Yeah, maybe how about every one of the main characters you flash against maybe some artwork from the books, like they do a little bit of flashy of the artwork, but just have their heads and shots with their names, and you can say, oh, this is the Torador clan, this is the Bruja clan, this is the Gangrel clan, and yeah. Then obviously the cop would just maybe have like a picture of like the shield on his badge for Los Angeles or something, you know, just...
It would have been nice, because there's a huge cast here, and if they just had the name of the actor or actress with their character name and their clan, that would have actually done a lot mitigate this confusion.
Or how about maybe with the symbols from the books, or maybe the lettering used, obviously it's kind of a, maybe it's budget, maybe it's money, I don't know. Until we ever have a producer of the show on our show to ask these questions to, we will never know. We will just speculate, and maybe they'll hear our podcast and go, oh, we have to go on their show and do corrections about us. I'm living
maybe
in a pet dream. Yes.
But, very confusing.
Yeah.
So the opening title ends, and we see Sasha in jail.
Yes, which is on par for course for her.
Yeah. She was previously in the last episode set up to be this like bad girl, and having the episode open with her in, kind of like a 24-hour lockdown, it seems, just a holding cell. Julian bails her out of there. And then they take this car drive where, Julian doesn't drive. He's got a driver. So he's in the car, they're talking, and this scene was exactly the scene that was taken from the extended pilot version, but it was recut.
Yeah, that's really odd.
Well, I like the way they cut it in this episode versus the extended pilot episode, because in the extended pilot, it opens when she's standing out of the sunroof of the car. Her attitude during the entire conversation is very kind of bitchy, kind of flippant, uses a lot more intonations of her voice that impart a bit more of a childish, selfish demeanor.
Uh-huh.
And this way it was cut, it seems a bit more compassionate for her. She's not standing out of the sunroof. She's just sitting in the car, talking to Julian, who's kind of in the back seat. You see across, and Julian is talking about fathers without children, or my kind, fathers without children, and offers to basically make Sasha his
ward.
Kind of a child, I guess, or
ward.
Caretaker.
Yeah, like Batman.
Yeah,
Robin
ward.
Is the Batman.
Yeah. Yeah. So without clearly saying that, it's definitely a ward status.
Just less creepy. Because they're related. And she's 18.
Oh, I think she's like 20.
Yeah, they completely dropped that whole Catholic school plot line, by the way.
Yeah, that was not in any of the episodes. I think that was just for the extended pilot version.
Yes.
Where they buy her some outfits and things like that.
Yes. Stick her in the outfits, that's fine. I had no problem seeing her in the Catholic schoolgirl outfit. Just don't, like, pursue that whole weird, like, thing with the nuns. Just whatever. Just stop that.
they're in the mansion, and she hears the motorcycle, thinking it's her motorcycle that's been taken from the jailhouse to the mansion.
Yep.
She runs out to the balcony and then sees Cash pulling up on his motorcycle. She's like, ooh, yum. Which, you know, I commented in the last podcast that, you know, yeah, she instantly got wet. She was totally turned on by seeing this guy pull up in his motorcycle, saying that the only things that he has on his person are what's in his saddlebags.
Yep.
And she's like, oh, I'm going to like living here.
Yeah. I like me some whatever's on that motorcycle.
Yeah.
And then Julian again has that great line, even though we heard it in the last episode. Oh, that can never happen. I'm putting a stop to that right now. I'd hate to put you down like the gangrel dog you are, which he says later on, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
We get back to the precinct where Frank's getting questioned by Eternal Affairs and over Boyle, and they don't confiscate his gun and badge, but his commanding officer, who's played by Yuji Okumoto, which I'm probably mispronouncing it, but I'm doing the best I can, who is an actor, by the way, you see in a lot of things. He has never had like a standing role for X number of episodes, but he is one of those actors who just appears in stuff, and he's been doing it since 1984 up until he's got two things coming out in 2017.
Wow.
Yeah, again, one of those actors.
Having solid work as a character actor, I mean, that's not something to shake a stick at, you know?
No, definitely not. He's in two episodes at least, so Bad Moon Rising and Prince of the City, but then again, he's one of those actors who keep showing up stuff. Clearly showing up in things with an Asian background and such. He was in The Karate Kid Part 2. That was a big role for him. He was like the bad guy in that movie, so.
This conversation with Internal Affairs seems to, by the time we step into it, it seems to have been going on for a long time. You know, Frank is frustrated with it. He's rolling his eyes. And the shooting of this scene was actually a bit jarring to me. The way they have the camera set up, it's pointed at Frank's back, so you can see his boss and Sonny, but it's from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
So the main focus is on Frank's back, and then you have the close-ups of Frank's face, and then his boss and his partner Sonny. I don't know. The scene to me just took me a little bit out of it because of the way they intentionally shot Frank's backside.
Okay.
But, you know, that's just style, you know, my two cents on the style.
No, that's fine. But it does look a little bit odd and off. You had mentioned you didn't like the way this episode had been shot, really. The cinematography is a bit
The pilot
different.
Was much better.
Yeah, the pilot's much better, and then other episodes are better, but for some reason, like, Prince of the City, the cinematography definitely changes a lot through the entire episode.
Mm-hmm. So, Frank is talking, and they're talking about an internal affairs investigation quite suddenly. You know, it's this like 180 turn of opinion where they're talking about having him going on getting investigated for this and about his obsession with vampires and then suddenly just says to tell Frank make it stick, you know. So he's letting Frank just go out and investigate this vampire thing, but to make it stick. Very sudden reversal. This is like total TV logic. You know, you want the main character to go out and, you know, get the right killer. But in reality, if you were being investigated by Internal Affairs, that would be the end of your job for a while.
Yeah.
Until the investigation is over.
You'd confiscate, you get your badge and gun confiscated, and that's it. You I don't even know if you get benefits. But that,
maybe if you were lucky, paid leave.
Yes, definitely. And then we cut to Julian at the club with getting dressed, going downstairs, and that's when Lillian points out that there is a reporter played by Caitlin Byrne, the reporter Caitlin Byrne, played by Kelly Rutherford, there to see him, who many of you might have seen her on another TV series, which was canceled just before this one, The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr., starring Bruce Campbell. And she is an actress who has been in multiple things recently on Gossip Girl for 120 episodes.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Melrose Place, she was on for 90 episodes. She's had some stints on some television shows, and she was on Reckless, and...
Definitely a face that I think everyone would recognize, even if they didn't know her name.
Oh, no, yeah. She is absolutely beautiful in this episode. And then, of course, you have... you have the blondes versus brunettes between Stacey Haydix, who plays Lillian, and Kelly Rutherford, as they are just like...
Yeah. that jealousy from Lily is very tangible. Quick trivia here. The song that's played in the nightclub, The Haven,
yep.
when they're sitting down at the table, Julian and Lily, is Waiting for the Miracle by Leonard Cohen.
Oh, cool. Oh, yes. And Leonard Cohen recently passed away this year.
He did.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Nah. That's the best. That's all you're going to get from me. get some drinks in me and I'll do the whole song.
That's a different show.
Yeah. What's the name of the article she's writing about Julian?
Oh, the name of the article is... The Most Powerful Man You've Never Met.
I love the title of that.
I mean, isn't that totally a BuzzFeed title?
Yes.
Right there?
Yeah.
That's clickbait.
And he agrees to the interview as long as she'll have dinner with him. Like, go on a date with me and I'll give you whatever you want.
Yeah. It's a bit of a compromise, and she's looking for information about him and have been asking about him all over the city, She sits down, Lily leaves, and they're kind of negotiating this, I'll give you an exclusive interview if you go out to dinner with me, and I can ask you a question, but you must promise to answer every question that I ask.
Quid pro quo, Clarice.
Yeah. Very similar, actually.
Yeah.
Very similar.
And considering what the appetite of Julian Luna and Hannibal Lecter's is, it's very similar.
Very similar. Yeah, they eat people.
Yeah. I will devour you. That word is used a lot. Not I will drink your blood or I will suck you dry. I'm going to devour you.
Devour you.
Is used a lot on this show.
Vampires themselves are very, primally visceral. So
yes, definitely.
Devouring, the intaking of someone's power and essence by sharing of blood or, that's very... I'm not surprised that they use the word, but to devour is a... I think more elegantly put than I'm going to eat you alive.
Definitely. Then we cut over to the morning, and Julian meets Frank at a diner for their bromance, and it's very kind of casual how they're meeting each other.
Did you notice the name of the diner? It's called the Nighthawk Diner.
Yes. Very brilliant. Yes, Nighthawk Diner, which is also the name of at least a couple different Marvel superheroes, too.
Oh, yeah.
Dress in various Nighthawk-like costumes. Frank's very cocky to Julian's like, the sun's almost coming up. Don't you got to be inside? And he's like, no, we can be outside for a little while if we've just fed. And then the very pretty waitress comes over and gives Julian a bloody martini or bloody...
Tomato juice.
Yes.
Blood red tomato juice.
Yes, and she, winks at him. So she's kindred, maybe? Because he points out that there's kindred in every walks of life because he can make the Eternal Affairs investigation go away. Julian is honor-bound by things he says. And if he told his ex-girlfriend, Frank's burning in flames girlfriend, that he will not kill Frank, he won't. He wants to become friends with Frank. They shared a woman. They have a connection. They both loved the same woman who had to die. And it kind of... binds them together on top of the fact that Julian is not the villain. He wants to be a good guy. He just has to do bad things to do it. And a cop that will help him out once in a while is a good thing. So he, makes a point to Frank that we can work together. We don't have to be enemies. And I can help you get the information you need to clear your name.
And all Frank wants to do is he wants to nail Eddie Fiore. When you say it like that, are we using phrasing? He wants to nail Eddie Fiore.
Julie and Caitlin get together for dinner, and she questions him, but every question he answers with something. wants to know about.
Totally inappropriate.
Oh, yeah. But you know what? If you were that type of reporter to me and that you really – and I was not giving you – you know what I mean? If you wanted to, like, get the inside story, I'm all over the internet, so it's – I got nothing to hide. but I would kind of be – in. I would be on Jillian's side about, like, listen, you want to get information out of me, but you're not giving me anything, and you're constantly hounding me, and you're calling my secretary and showing up at all hours of the night.
yeah.
And he asked her, what was the last time you had sex?
Yeah.
Because we could totally bang right here if you want.
You know, what happened to you as a girl that made you stuff your own emotions?
Basically.
You know,
yeah.
That similarity you put between Hannibal Lecter, Clarice, and this scene, very appropriate here. Because, you know, the questions that Hannibal asks Clarice are entirely inappropriate and have nothing to do with the case that she's working on. And these questions, you know, what would happen if you were to lose control of your emotions?
Yeah. And we will learn later on in upcoming episodes why it is she's so closely guarded and what she did, which at the time in 1996 was pretty taboo. It's well, not taboo, but just kind of it's still not looked upon as being fantastic. I'm not going to get into the politics behind what she says, but we'll get there eventually because it will be revealed in an upcoming episode. It's not revealed in this episode. Then Sasha, Cash is in the garage working on his motorcycle, and Sasha shows up in this tiny little dress and a leather jacket, and the words exchanged between them are not about a motorcycle. It is clearly about having sex.
Oh, yes. You know, and specifically, like, she is called Forbidden Fruit.
Oh, yes.
She's called Forbidden Fruit. Like, yo, you're Julian's. I can't. It's Forbidden Fruit. But she walks over to her motorcycle. She kind of leans up against it, jutting out her hips. And as she's saying, maybe I'll let you take it out for a ride sometime, clearly talking about her pussy.
Yeah, she is opening her legs to him with the dress covering it. It's a Fox show. Fox goes to certain levels, but not all the way there. but it's also, by the way, don't forget, this is an Aaron Spelling show. This is the age of 90210 and Melrose Place. Which, by the way, Kelly Rutherford got a job on Melrose Place after this TV series was canceled. They were not, and also Models, Inc. too, by the way. This was not the age of, like, let's just not even go there. No, this was the age of, like, we're going to tiptoe around it and call it other things. But if this was on HBO, we would use words like penis and vagina and stuff like that.
Yeah. And Sasha, clearly fishing for compliments, you know, she says, like, if you tell me what especially you like about it. So it's like, okay, well, she's fishing for compliments from Cash, wanting Cash to tell her what he liked about her, but using motorcycle references.
By the way, these two do not know each other at all.
They've never had a conversation. You know, all she knows is, I am attracted to this guy, and Cash is, I am attracted to her, and that is it.
Yep.
You know, so he rattles off these thinly veiled references for her in his motorcycle jargon.
Yep.
And she says, look at my dress. I wore it for you. Oh, you know, she could not be any more transparent with the request for sex.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though Julian told him earlier, that can never happen.
That can never happen.
That can never happen, Cash.
But yet he goes and kisses her anyway, even though she's forbidden fruit.
Which might put him
in bad graces with his boss, Julian.
Yes.
Who would, quote, tear his heart out and eat it.
I would love to see that.
Yeah, the primogen of the Gangrel crowd having his heart torn out and eaten because he fucked his great-great-great-niece.
Yeah, great-great-niece is probably the best way to put it. Yeah. Back to the Haven. There's a lot of scene switching in this episode, by the way. thankfully, we don't have like 25 characters like Game of Thrones, but man, there is a lot of scene switching in this episode. Lillian and Julian are arguing over Caitlin and what to do about Caitlin when Frank shows up at the club. And that's when Frank shows up, right? No, it's after. Sorry. I'm jumping ahead in my notes. Frank doesn't show up until later on. Cash shows up with Sasha, And then Sasha wants to hang out, but Julian's like, I got a job for you. Can you do it for me tonight? Yeah, boss, whenever you want. Get my niece home before I kill you.
yeah, because Sasha tricked Cash into bringing her to the Haven just so that they could hang out and maybe have a date. I don't know. Brought her over to the club. Julian then says, get her out of here. And, of course, he has to obey.
Yeah, and then we cut to Frank back at the diner without Julian. I'm wondering if there's like a bad cut here because I kept watching the episode and I was reading episode synopsis online and it seems like Julian leaves and then Frank finishes alone and that's what Eddie shows up with Sonny going, let's wind him up like a little toy and send him after Julian, maybe turn him into a Bruja. Or he doesn't show up as Sonny, but he shows up with one of his goons, his Bruja goons. So I'm just wondering if there's like some bad cut editing going on and I'm not entirely sure. Just because, again, Frank is kind of wearing the same thing in the diner when Eddie shows up. Yeah, I don't know. Again, the editing of a lot of these episodes can be a little choppy in here or there, so I'm not going to totally nitpick it, considering, you know, the love of the show is not 100% there. Frank and Julian do meet at the Haven and gives Julian
the pinky ring.
The pinky ring.
Yeah,
and that's when
Eddie's haste with Nino, they were taking all of the valuables off of this corrupt union leader.
Yep.
But they couldn't get the goddamn pinky ring off, which is surprising for a vampire because why wouldn't they just rip off the entire pinky? But they didn't. You know, maybe they were too much of a hurry. So he has this pinky ring.
Yep.
And as we learned in the previous episode, in the pilot episode, a vampire can look at an object and then see the last engagement of a person with this object.
Correct. Yep. Well, this is also where Lillian meets Frank for the first time, and they have a very kind of sexual tension exchange going on when she says, hey, Frank, I heard you tasted Alexandra. And he's like, I'll have to tell you about that sometime. And then he asks her, what clan are you? And she looks at Frank, she looks at Julian, smiles, because she knows that Frank has been doing his homework as a cop, and like, I'm the Torridor clan. We're the sex symbols. Do you want to have sex with me, Frank? I bet you do.
And then she just so ever so coyly like makes a small cut on Frank's hand and takes her pinky and licks it off, and very sexy, very seductress like.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed to be a little bit as if Lily was pushing Frank's buttons on this, trying to get him to react. And Frank didn't react to the cut on the hand. It didn't really react to her drinking his blood, and she just kind of wanders off while Julian and Frank are talking about this pinky ring.
Yep. Sony meets Eddie at there and has the intention to kill Julian, and then that's when we learn Eddie is a double agent working for Julian. Because Julian is his sire, which we learned in the previous episode, and he fed Eddie a bunch of garbage to get Eddie on his side. I don't think this plot line is carried over anymore from any more episodes.
It's very odd, because you have the Ventru clan noticing that they have a traitor.
Yep.
And it was stated that they have a traitor in their midst, and then they bring in Sonny, and Sonny is confronted with being the traitor. And Sonny says that, and he fell for it. And then they all congratulate each other. All of that little setup for you're a traitor is just farce, because everyone knows that he's the double agent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, you know, Sonny and Julian talk about Eddie and what the movement of his clan is doing. Eddie had basically casually talked about bringing Frank into the Bruja clan. I think this is what prompts a little bit later Julian's troops giving Frank the phosphorus gun, which we'll get to towards the end of the episode.
Yeah, there's a gun on his coffee table, and he gets the phone call from Sonny that the prince will protect him.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sonny is a very interesting character simply because not only is he Julian's childer and Frank's
good
partner.
Good word.
Yeah, well, that's a term for it, the childer.
Yeah, when you sire another vampire, that's your childer.
Yeah.
In the cases of certain vampires on like Angel, Buffy, True Blood, if it's a woman, they seem to have like a relationship beyond it being like parent and son, because Angel slept with Darla, Eric, you know, had vampires that he created that he slept with, or Bill the vampire from True Blood. I always thought that was kind of weird, you know, like that's now your kind of kid, even though you're not. You are blood related, but you're blood related to any vampire, really, because all the vampires are related. I mean, as it, on the DNA microscopic level. But it always was really weird with me. I've written a story about vampires, and in my story, my main character does create a vampire at the very end of the first book. And then as I'm writing the second book, he is not going to sleep with his child vampire he created.
Yeah.
It's just weird, in my opinion.
Well, vampires in Vampire the Masquerade, they have different motivations for whom they will embrace and under what conditions. Now, the Ventru have a long process that they go through. Like, a Ventru person being embraced through the Ventru clan has process where they have to learn the laws and learn the dynamics and get quizzed, and the elders have to approve, and this huge status raising type of activity. Now they can turn anyone and have them be just cannon fodder for them, but to really be brought into the Ventru status symbol clan, then they have a long process. The Bruja, though, have not. You know, the Brujas typically will embrace someone based on how useful they are to the purposes of the sire. So whether it is to screw over someone or to they have some resources or benefits that the sire wants, you know, gain something. So in this episode, the Bruja stealing the objects off of the union worker kind of goes along with how Brujas operate, you know, because they're always looking for something to gain.
Mm-hmm.
That is kind of a big motivation for just the clan in generally, because Brujas are a strong clan, but they're also very generalists. So you can find a Bruja in all walks of life, because they don't typically will gravitate to one or the other. They use their strength and their presence to command people in audiences and have that type of large audience sway, the charm, if you will. But what they're seeking from an embraced person is something that they can get out of them. So for them to just casually say, well, bring him into the Bruja clan, that is specifically done with that purpose to screw him over.
It's all a big conspiracy against Julian, which the whole focus of the whole show, it's touched upon more in like episodes like this and the previous one. It's Julian is trying to make sure there is no clan war, because that's something... As the prince of the city, you need to do is not have the clans fighting amongst each other. Otherwise, you will get absurd as prince and carry on to someone else. Archon points that out to Julian before Sunny shows up.
Mm-hmm. And Gangrels and Brujas, at just the, you know, visceral level, they do not like each other.
Yeah.
So those two clans are at odds all the time, because the Gangrels can smell a Bruja, and the Brujas can sense a Gangrel.
Yes.
It's kind of a weird little duality between them, but they are always clashing. So keeping the peace is pretty much Julian's job as the prince of the city here.
Yeah. And I want to point out that I've noticed this always from the very beginning, and now that I have a great voice to speak about it on my own podcast, the Gangrels are very much like the jocks in high school back in the 50s, and the Brujas... Sorry, the Gangrels are like the... I already messed this up. Okay, let me start over. The Gangrels are like the greasers in a 50s-style movie, like American Graffiti or Grease, or, you know, any kind of film from the 50s.
Well, they're
and
always wearing leather.
Yeah, exactly. And the Bruja are like the jocks, the athletes. There is, again, I can't believe I'm mentioning this movie reference, but Kingdom of the Crystal Skull... As bad as that movie is, there is one scene in that movie where Shia LaBeouf, Indiana Jones' son, oh, spoiler, starts a fight between a bunch of greasers and a bunch of jocks at a diner.
Yeah, yeah.
And immediately I was thinking of Kindred the Embraced when I saw that.
Yeah, the gangros and the brujas at it again.
Yeah. good stuff. And also, there's a... Sonny has a really nice compliment towards Frank where he says, he's my partner. He's a good cop, Julian. I love him. You know, he actually, he shares to Julian, not like to Frank. Frank doesn't may or may not believe him. He shares to Julian that he really deeply cares about Frank. He's a cop, even though he's a vampire, he's still a police officer. And your partner is your brother out there on the streets. He will watch your back and take a bullet for you. That's what partners in police work do. And talk to any cop, and their partner is their brother. And he treats Frank like his brother, even though he is a vampire and he has to protect the masquerade. And he's loyal to his prince, who's his sire. He's loyal to his partner, too. So he's at a kind of a conflict, but he's glad that Julian's not going to kill Frank.
Sonny is actually the anonymous voice on the phone that gives him this advice and tips and kind of guides him.
Yep.
Sonny also tries to prevent Frank from really digging into much in depth into the vampire lore.
Yeah, at the library.
There's a scene where, in this episode, where Frank is poring over books, you know, these old tomes, very thick texts about the vampires and you know, what you can do to spot a vampire and their strengths and shortcomings. And Sonny is like, oh, this is just, you know, it's folklore, it's nothing, and just trying to get him off of the vampire trail and put him back onto something a little bit more productive towards Julian's goals.
That line just always kind of throws me, because immediately when he says that to Frank, they're old books, they should be burned. I'm like, okay, Nazi. the Kindred Conclave, I like that word, conclave, meet up and they have a vote about what to do with Eddie endangering the masquerade once again. And it's Eddie gets kind of a pass, and his Bruja buddy, the one who actually killed Boyle, is
Nino.
He is sentenced to death. So that's when they give Frank the gun to do away with the vampire. He shows up, by the way, in the most ridiculous scene ever, and this again has to do with bad writing. And just, he's like, I'm here to make your Bruja.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
That's the line? I'm here to make you Bruja?
Yeah, and Frank, because that phosphorus gun, he's ready for him, and he just blows him away.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then go ahead.
I want to talk a little bit about that conclave, though.
Okay.
Conclave is the word for the general meetings that are held by Justicars.
Okay.
Now, a Justicar there's only one Justicar per clan. Now, I think in the television show, they're not really putting forth the full spectrum of what the Kindred legal system is. Because,
the legal system.
Because, you know, it's a show. You don't want to introduce too many characters.
No, because that will never work.
Yeah. So the Conclave can only be called by a Justicar, and there's only one per clan, and these are one per clan worldwide. So these Justicars yield tremendous power. And so the Justicars, when one of the Justicars comes into town, you may only know a few days to a week ahead of time, and then anyone under the rule of the city and the power structure can come to a conclave meeting. So it's kind of like the Vampire Congress. So you have the Justicars, which are the judge juries of the entire thing. They're kind of an executioner type of person as well. They rule on clan dynamics. They are the highest level of legislation. They're the ones that actually are the voices for the inner circle. And the inner circle are the vampires that are actually ruling the entire world. You know, they're the highest of the high. The identities of the inner circle are mysterious and unknown, because in order to have this be public, they would put themselves in danger. So before a Justicar comes into town, what usually happens is that the prince of the city will clean house. He will get rid of any mortal human that knows about the vampires, knows about Kindred, because if he didn't, then it would he put himself in danger to get his life forfeited as well. Because if the Justicar finds out that the Masquerade has been broken, then it's the Justicar's duty to basically change princes, put to death, really do any sort of legislative measures in order to correct the situation. So the Justicar, who each of these Justicars is served by several Archeons. And so these Archons are the servants, they're the enforcers. Having a Justicar come to your city means terror for the vampires, because that means, like, oh, the big boss is in town. And in the Vampire the Masquerade mythos, around this time period, 1998, one of the manuals actually has the Bruja Justicar is Jaroslav Paschek, and the Venture Justicar is Lucinid. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but Nosferatu Justicar was Cockrobin.
Okay.
Very interesting name there.
We might have a correction on Reddit. We had a list of notes, which I don't have time to go over in this episode, on Reddit about certain vampire terms, which I might get to when we have our Vampire the Masquerade special guest on at the end of this show's the 8 episodes we do of Kindred the Embraced.
Oh, yes, please. Anyone listening out there, feel free to correct us. We are not the end-all be-all of this, and if you guys are playing the system, watching the show with us, you know, please add your comments. We love it.
Mm-hmm. To get back to the episode, because we're crunching now for time. For everyone listening, we're trying to keep these podcast episodes under an hour. Last week's was a little bit longer, only because of the episode itself was a bit longer. So we are always trying to plan for these to be under an hour. After Frank kills the Bruja. Yeah, the phosphorus gun. So Frank kills the Bruja with the phosphorus gun, and then he meets with Julian at the diner again. Mm-hmm. Right? Yes.
Yes,
he meets and convinces him that there can be peace between human and Kindred. And it kind of goes right back to Julian pointing out to Caitlin that he now owns the newspaper that she works at, and he is her boss, and she is the city editor.
Yeah.
And she can do whatever she wants with any story. And it's basically so Julian can control the newspaper. Julian is trying to do what certain presidential candidates are trying to do. Oh, what am I saying? Okay. and
The one difference there is that Julian tells the reporter, Caitlin, I trust you.
Yes.
You can run whatever you want. I trust you over it. Now, that's a pretty big thing to tell a reporter because that's doing a report on you, that you trust him, that he trusts her, and that she can produce whatever she wants.
Yep.
And so his mentor in this episode had called him out on his relationship with this reporter because he just offered her a job, bought her paper just to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And Julian says, I'm drawn towards her.
And by the way, this is something that for staying in a fictional world and not getting political into the real world about people trying to control newspapers. If anyone's reading, I'm a big comic book fan. And currently in Action Comics of the new DC Rebirth, Lex Luthor bought the Daily Planet to control the news. This never being a successful thing for him, because not realizing he is now Superman's boss, but he is the boss of, like, you know, Lois Lane, because Superman doesn't currently work at the Daily Planet. This is something like supervillains or kind of good guy bad guy characters like Julian is does in order to control the media.
Yeah, it's very much a control issue that if you control the media, you control the message.
Definitely.
And we also might see this come up in Daredevil. The more times that a large, powerful person controls different elements of a city, the more the city is apt to listen to that person.
Yeah. Archon then makes a point to Julian that being with Caitlin could lead to the destruction of the Masquerade, could lead to the destruction of Julian. And he basically very politely, you know, blows his sire off. And then I'm trying to picture what Julian is doing, because he comes out into his mansion in very slow motion, jumps into the air. Does he turn into a bat? Do you think Julian is flying over the city with his arms spread out like Superman?
You know, I don't know. They don't show a bat or an animal that he is turning into, but it's clear that, you know, with the helicopter shot, that it's trying to illustrate that he's flying somehow.
Yeah, but so, can you imagine Julian with his arms, like, spread out from side to side, not in front of him, but side to side, like a like he's on a cross. Get it, vampires. And he is just flying to be a peeping Tom.
and flying over to Caitlin's house. Yeah, and Caitlin is sleeping with her porch door open. Who does that in San Francisco?
In 1996.
But, yeah, and flies over, and Julian basically is, like, trying to watch her sleeping. She's cuddling with a huge teddy bear, just a huge teddy bear, in this gossamer-style nightgown, and the episode ends with basically her with this look on her face like, oh, what was that? You know, no one's there.
Not a great ending to the episode, I think. I don't like that whole, like, what?
You know, but that's where the episode ends. And, you know, I'm looking forward to next week, because next week is just a one-shot. It has nothing to do with the plot line that we've just been talking about.
No, it's actually the unaired episode, which the show was unfortunately canceled before this episode aired. Fox has this bad habit of airing episodes out of order, i.e. Firefly. Next week's episode, the next week's episode of the TV series, we will be recording that on Christmas, will be an example of that. So I'm actually really looking forward to that. Couple quick notes over on social media. We have hit over 100 followers on the Dead TV Podcast Facebook page.
Yay! Thank you, everyone!
Couple things I want to point out real quick. We are going to have a Patreon set up for the Radio of Horror Network on Patreon. So if you want to donate to help the Dead TV Podcast pay for equipment and other things that we might need, like expanding our service provider for where we stick the episodes and other stuff, it's not going to be. I want people to realize that when we have the Patreon page set up for all of the Dr. Chris radio shows, which is part of the Radio Horror Network, which includes the Dead TV Podcast, Supernatural Creatures and Lore, the Dr. Chris Radio Horror Show, and YouTube, the money is really going to be spent on things like equipment, going to conventions, stuff like that. It's not pocket change right away. It's really going to be helping the show if people need a headset, they need new Skype stuff, things like that. So,
there are costs involved, so please,
yes,
follow us on YouTube, please comment, rate our production.
Yes, that is the big thing.
We look forward to giving you many years of delightful entertainment every 2 weeks.
Yes. The big thing that you can do to help right now, if you can't donate a buck or two, go to iTunes, the Dead TV Podcast. Just type it in the search bar under the store section of iTunes, and please, if you listen, leave a rating. Ratings help tremendously, because it shows other people the popularity of the show. So you can do it there, and I just uploaded our show to Google Play, so I'm waiting approval on Google Play. So for everyone who doesn't have an iPod or an iTunes account and doesn't want to use iTunes or time...
want to listen to it on the Radio of Horror website.
Yes, that's right. The Radio Horror website will allow you to download it to an MP3 device. Fortunately, if you have an iPod or an iPhone, you do have to use iTunes, because anything downloaded on an Apple device will require you to use iTunes. It's just the way it's set up. Unfortunately, there is nothing we can do about that. But that's why I've uploaded it to Google Play, because a lot of people have complained that they don't have access to iTunes, they don't use it. So it's going to be on Google Play as soon as they approve it, but you can always listen to it on an MP3 device or your home computer or whatever thing that's not Apple on the RadioHorror.com website. Mr. Zeneca, why don't you give out your website?
Well, you can always see me here on this podcast, and if you go to my website, ElegantlyKinky.com, I post news and updates there as well.
And you can find me at www.radiohorror.com, radiohorror.wordpress.com, and the Radio Horror Facebook page, as well as on Twitter, at ChrisDSAV. All those links can be found on radiohorror.wordpress.com, just in case you missed it. Thank you, Mr. Zeneca, for joining me for this episode, Prince of the City.
Thank you so much, Dr. Chris, and thank you to all of our listeners, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.